We are in session at the Commonwealth Club, and we have the great privilege tonight to have the chance to talk with General Stanley McChrystal, who is a senior fellow at the Jackson Institute at Yale University, where he also teaches leadership. He had a distinguished, and he runs a company in his spare time, the McChrystal Group, that does management consulting and leadership education for CEOs and other senior folks. He had a very distinguished 34-year career in the American military. His last assignment was as the commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. And he also, perhaps the greatest distinction of his time in the military was the way that he, in from 2004 to 2008 or 9, wrenched the institution of intelligence gathering and operations in the American military into a much more dynamic and helpful organization than it had ever had been. I was the director for defense strategy on the National Security Council staff in the White House at the time. And you could feel the organic changing of the institution as General McChrystal undertook some of the things he's going to talk to you about tonight. It's a really extraordinary case study in institutional vitality and revitalization. And about the speed of understanding and the response at which things can happen. I've always thought it was wonderfully illustrative that the home of disruptive technology and innovation sits along the San Andreas Fault here in California, and which means, General McChrystal, you are right at home here. Won't you, Commonwealth Club members, join me in welcoming Stan McChrystal?
Thank you. Thanks so much.
I'm going to start by talking about the one of the best reviews I read of your book was from Gautam Mukunda at the Harvard Business School, and he talked about the way every organization deals with the challenge of sustained adaptability, and that what he saw in your book was a particular emphasis on the restraint a leader needs to have in this environment to avoid micromanaging. Given the transparency that you have into the organization, how do you resist micromanaging? And in particular, for your challenge, transforming the special operations, how did you, given that the consequences of empowered junior leaders making mistakes, the consequences are so enormous in the environment in which you were doing it. How did you think about that challenge? To what extent did you protect bad decisions when they were made? Help CEOs in less demanding but equally important businesses understand how you thought about those challenges.
Yeah, I have a big advantage over most because I'm really lazy, and so I don't really want to do very much. And that gives
nobody
me,
believes that.
Yeah, that gives me an advantage.
Nobody believes that.
Think about today's world. If you are a closet micromanager, this is your age. You can have two or three smartphones. You can have three or four computers. You can have assistants. You can get information from everywhere in real time. You can talk to anyone in your organization. In my situational awareness room, what we called it, we had about 12 screens on the wall, and they were all showing operations in real time, full motion video, we called it, like live TV, from Predator unmanned aerial vehicles above them. So we could watch every one of our operators land in a helicopter, get out of a vehicle, move on the target. And because of a system we set up that went through our secure internet, we could hear every radio transmission. And if I was sitting in Baghdad, I could hear radio transmissions from a raid in Afghanistan. And if I wanted to, I could reach down and talk to Sergeant X on the ground on an objective in Afghanistan. Now, I never did that, but the technology now allows you to do that. So the first thing to understand is that's deceptive. It's seductive and deceptive, because if you see things in two dimensions, you get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph, you know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions. You don't know how tired people are. You don't hear the crack of bullets. You don't feel whether it's cold or hot. You don't have a sense of the fight like someone on the ground does. And so the first thing to do is understand the limits of what technology tries to give you an appreciation of. The second is, although you have that ability to micromanage the scale and speed at which things happen, if you come up to you, you're trying to micromanage, when we're doing 300 raids a month, I got 10 going at once, there's no way a single individual or even a small headquarters can process that information accurately enough, pass it down, and not be too slow for changes on the ground. And so the temptation to micromanage is there, but it has to be tempered by the humility to understand what you don't know. At the same time, we're in an area of huge accountability. We talk about the strategic corporal, and it's very true. Any soldier on the battlefield can do something or fail to do something that's on the front page of the New York Times tomorrow, and not positively. And so suddenly, there's this temptation also to say, I've got to put controls in because I am responsible, I am accountable for things that this huge force is doing at speed, and then you got to back off and say, well, guess what? I really can't do that anyway. I've got to trust them. Now, my response to that is say, you can't control them anyway. The speed at which and complexity at which is happening, it's a loser's game to try. So what can you do? What you can do is help them. Instead of having information at the highest headquarters and then allowing people on the bottom to be trying to figure out what's going on, you can turn the flow of information so that it pushes down to everybody on the battlefield in the hopes that you give them as much strategic understanding as possible, this contextual shared awareness or shared consciousness, as we call it, so that they understand the big picture, and then you got to trust them that they're going to process that. Now, we talked about every 24 hours we did this video teleconference. That got everybody a picture of what's happening, so they understand what we're trying to do, what the situation is, and then you've got to trust their judgment, and you've got to try to help them along with it. But micromanagement is something that is tempting, but it's the great trap nowadays, I believe.
So I have a whole list of questions, none of which I'm going to ask you, because the questions we have gotten from the audience are numerous and terrific. So I'm going to go straight to the audience questions, several of which deal with the risks of information sharing. Several people had questions asking how in an organization that flat, where you have 7,500 people on the conference call, do you keep people from leaking information or from mistakenly sharing information? How did you handle that challenge?
Well, the first thing to understand is if you put ironclad rules to prevent the potential leak of information, nobody's going to communicate. And the cure is worse than the disease at that point. If you go back and read the 9/11 report, all of the information necessary to stop the 9/11 plot existed inside the U.S. government. All of it existed. We just couldn't connect the dots. We couldn't connect the dots not because people didn't want to, but because our processes and cultures didn't facilitate that happening. And so what I've come to the conclusion is there is risk in sharing information. Every once in a while, you'll have a Bradley/Chelsea Manning, who will take information and leak it. And you almost can't prevent that completely. But what I would say is, although there's cost to it, the cost of trying to stop the flow of information is even greater. So transparency is also good. In our tactical operations every day, several things happen. One, they were at the top secret level, so 7,500 people getting top secret information every day. There's a risk to that. But a lot of it was temporal. If things are happening fast enough, if somebody hears a secret, many of the things we talked about 48 hours later, they might still be secret, but they weren't relevant because the situation had changed. So if you tie yourself in knots about that, sometimes you can avoid to do it. Now, there were certain things you have to protect. We protected the identity of sources, spies. We kept personnel information because you respect for people to do that. You've got to be. But if your culture becomes one of, we only share information with who needs to know, then I would challenge you with who knows what people need to know. We would frequently be going after a target in Iraq, and right before we'd go after the target, the CIA would contact us and say, hey, that person's our source. And I'd say, whoa, 15 minutes later, and we'll bring them to you in a bag. I mean, think about it. And so sharing information becomes very, very important.
I really like the point about the opportunity costs of not sharing, that it's not an absolute, it's a relative scale. So several of our people in the audience actually quoted passages of your book in the question, which I've not had happen before in chairing Commonwealth Club things. So I think you should take that as a huge compliment that people are already reading the book. And I'm going to go to those questions to reward those folks who actually did. So the first is, in the chapter Symmetries, you say empowered execution without shared consciousness is dangerous. Can you explain that more?
Sure. If you tell somebody to go out and do something, make decisions, but they don't have the information, it's almost like telling people to drive from here to there and you don't give them a map or you don't give them the dangers on the route. It's pretty hard to expect them to be effective. And so I think what we owe organizations now that things are going so fast is you can't micromanage them and tell them exactly what to do. So give them every bit of information possible so they can understand it and figure it out for themselves. I think it's the responsibility we have in today's environment. Mm-hmm.
Another question asks what your biggest leadership challenge in Iraq and Afghanistan was. And I would actually spread that out into two, because it seems to me those two wars are very different in all sorts of ways, not least of which is that in Iraq, in your time, it was the main focus of the government's effort, and you had a very strongly American-led operation in partnership with the Iraqis. In Afghanistan, it was not as much of a priority. Moreover, it was a much larger team. How did that affect your leadership in those environments? That is, how do you build a trusted team with that much diversity and that many potentially different interests?
Sure. I'll take the first one. In Iraq, I was in charge of Joint Special Operations Command, which is counterterrorist forces. Now, we were a bounded organization that I had grown up in, so fairly familiar with. Still, it has challenges of any organization. But the real challenge was we needed to be an interagency team, much more broad. We needed all the different parts of the government to be part of that. And yet, I didn't command anybody outside my organization. Yet, we needed all the participation of all the different parts of government, and I couldn't task them. Actually, in the U.S. government construct, the only person who can task other organizations to support somebody is the president, and he's got other things to do. And so what my major challenge and effort was to build a team on handshakes and influence and relationships so that we would get all of the different players, the CIA, the FBI, Department of State, all to be part of this, all to get a unified effort in a very complex environment, and to have a unified mission, a shared vision of what our objective was. I probably spent the vast majority of my energy and effort doing that because I didn't spend my time down micromanaging about what target we're going to hit or how we're going to do it. Had people who were very competent at that. And so while it might have felt good because that's where I grew up, it wasn't the right role for me. The right role was in shaping the garden. Afghanistan was different. My role in Iraq was fairly focused, and it was within a larger counterinsurgency strategy, but it was focused. In Afghanistan, the situation was different when I took over. I took over in the summer of 2009, and as you remember, just about everybody was tired of us being in Afghanistan. The American people were tired and frustrated. The European allies and others from around the world, there were 46 nations in our coalition. They were all somewhat skeptical and tired of the effort. The Afghan people, who had had huge expectations for how life would be after we entered in the fall of 2001, they'd had these expectations that thought their progress would be like this, and the progress had been like this. Now, maybe their expectations were unrealistic, but it doesn't matter. The gap was real to them. And so they were frustrated, and they were terrified we were going to leave. Because in 1989, with the departure of the Soviets, the Americans had left. We had stopped being involved in the region. They'd broken down into civil war, and they thought we were going to do that again. So they had, almost like a child who's been abandoned by parents, they had a fear of that. And others, like the Pakistanis, had a position, and they were looking to see whether we were committed and what we were going to do long term, and they were trying to hedge their bets and base their policy on an assessment of what we were likely to do. And so the big challenge there was to change people's mindset, to change people into a belief, because the mission, as I derived it from the president, was protect the sovereignty of Afghanistan, prevent it from becoming a safe haven for Al-Qaeda again, which meant prevent the Taliban from undermining the government of Afghanistan. So my mission actually was to protect the entity that we were trying to help stand up on its feet. And because of that, we had to try to change the mindset of people and increase the confidence of the Afghan people. Until you can increase the confidence of Afghans particularly, there's no way they were going to side with their government. Because nobody wants to be the last person that jumps onto the side of the losing team. And so they were necessarily hedging their bets, trying to see which way this was going to go. And I viewed my major task was to convince people that we could, should, and would be effective in allowing that to happen.
One of my favorite examples of that you use in the book actually isn't about Afghans. It's about the way you shaped the garden, the mindset of American military forces operating in Afghanistan. That is, the simple central question you ask them of what would you do if you didn't get to go home until this war was won?
Yeah.
And I think that's a terrific example for leaders in every line of work about thinking your way to what's the essential thing you can ask or demonstrate to your organization that will refocus them on what you want them focused on. I think it's a terrific example. Several people in their questions bring up the issue of resilience, which you talk a lot about in the book, and you didn't talk about much in your comments tonight. Can you say a little bit more to address those questions about how you build resilience in an organization?
Sure. You have got to start with the assumption that complexity is going to produce fundamental unpredictability, impossible to predict things, and therefore you can't build something that's brittle. The idea that something will knock down what you've created is almost a given. And so what you've got to do is create organizations that repair themselves. You know, someone once used the example of the pyramids. The pyramids are pretty sturdy and they don't get knocked down easily, but they're not very resilient once they get knocked down. They're not apt to fix themselves. And so what you've got to do is in an organization is to create the mindset that we don't necessarily know the right answer, but we are going to adjust to the right answer every day. And so that resiliency is really bound up in learning. It's in figuring out what's happening, learning what must be done, and adapting to that.
One of the questions asks, what organizations or institutions meet your standard for resiliency in that regard? Can you give some examples?
Department of Motor Vehicles, I guess, you know. yeah, well, this is very interesting. There are not a lot, if you think about it. Most of us think of small teams or small startups, and there's this organic nature to them where trust and common purpose come easily and shared consciousness, you're around a kitchen table or in a small thing, just is effortless to create. And there's not a lot of empowered execution needed because everybody's empowered almost to begin with. But once you get above a certain size, you start to get large, the dynamics change. The size of a U.S. infantry company is about 100 people. What's the size of a Roman company a century? Thousands of years ago. It was 100 people. And that's because the basic dynamic is you can understand and know and deal with about 100 people. That's about the max you can do. A few people can do more, some people do less. But the reality is there's a limit. And so you can create this team effect and say, I'm on a great team. But once a team gets above 100 people, I would argue it can't be just a team. It has to become a team of teams. And so now what you're running into is organizations that have to take these teams and create the same dynamics between teams that exist between individuals. And that's a challenge. Think of who you don't like. And we've got a part in the book we talk about this with the SEALs. They talk about the point after which everyone sucks. That's a little crude, but think about it. You like people in your team, in your platoon. You kind of tolerate people in your squadron, but beyond that, everybody sucks because you don't know them. Now think about, we don't know people in another organization, you're suspicious, but what if you know one person in that organization? Like you don't trust an organization, but you get to know one person and you ask them sort of cautiously, how are the other people in your organization? And they go, well, they're pretty much like me. Suddenly you have a completely different vision of what that organization is. So suddenly, if you build relationships between individuals and organizations that cross those lines, suddenly that's one way you can start to build team of teams. And then there are disciplined processes for sharing information, because what we don't like is the unknown. We don't trust another religion because we don't kind of understand what they really believe and why they believe that. But once you do, you say it's a different perspective. They've been raised a different way, different perspective. It's not scary. Suddenly, the ability to create that, the dynamics between teams becomes possible. There aren't a lot of organizations. There are some that we deal with that I won't name that make a huge effort to do that, and they are massively advantaged against their competition because of it.
So what you said about diversity and kind of the unknown leads to the next question, which is, what role do gender and race differences, what nuances do they bring into building teams of teams?
Yeah. Everything that has a cultural difference or a potential barrier creates something that has to be worked across. Think about it. Age differences in an organization. You think differently, you have a different perspective. Gender differences, cultural differences. We work with organizations that are international in nature, and what we find is responses in interactions will be very different. We had a situation in Afghanistan in 2005 where I had the British Special Air Service that was working with us as part of our task force. And they went on an operation, and as they landed helicopters, they took an amazing amount of fire from this building, small arms and machine gun fire. And so appropriately, they held back, and they called for fire support from an AC-130 gunship. And I could watch from in the situational awareness room, I could watch this happening, I could see the fire. They engaged the building, did the right thing, went in. Later that day or early the next morning, there was an accusation that they had killed civilians in the building. Now, there could have been civilians in the building. There were absolutely Al-Qaeda in the building, so their actions were appropriate and necessary in combat. But whenever there's any accusation of civilian casualties, we institute an investigation. And I was an American commander, so I instituted an investigation called a 15-6. And that starts to investigate. Now, all my American units automatically knew that whenever you have an accusation, that's what you do to make sure that you get to the bottom of it and handle it correctly. Well, my Brit forces didn't know that. They weren't from our organization. And so they drew a conclusion that General Stan didn't want them to use gunships and didn't really trust them because, heck, he's investigating us. Well, about 3 weeks later, they're doing another operation, which I'm also watching. They land helicopters. They start to move at a building. They take a lot of fire, and I'm waiting, watching, expecting to see the gunship, and they charge directly at the building, and I watch them pull four of their comrades back, wounded. Fortunately, none died, and I was stupefied. I said, what are they doing? Then I watched them assault again, and I said, what in the world is happening? Now, they worked their way through it, and they finally took the building, but what I realized in the aftermath was that was my fault. It was my fault because I didn't explain to them what my intent was with the investigation. I didn't explain to them our culture of investigations. And I set them up to do something that they knew was wrong, but they thought what I wanted. And that's a failure as a commander. And so, small difference, because we think there's no difference between us and the Brits. Imagine us and where there's a language difference and other changes. So I really am sensitive to the fact that even though someone shares so many things with you, you have to understand there are many things that they may have in a different background.
So we have only a couple of minutes left. You guys can see this enormous stack of questions that sadly we are not going to get to. But I want to give the last question to someone who asks, what's happening now in Iraq and understanding the structure of Al-Qaeda and ISIS as you do. What should the U.S. do?
That's easy.
You didn't think I was going to let him get off without that one, did you?
Yeah. I would argue that the status quo is probably not a good course of action, so we need to look at where we are. ISIS is a 21st century thing. You know, we think of it as this religious movement that's come out of nowhere, and it has the look of some that may have come 100 years ago, but it's different. ISIS grew in 21st century, and there are some things about it that are therefore fundamentally different. First, like its predecessor, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, they're not a hierarchical structure. Al-Baghdadi does not control all the parts of ISIS in a daily meeting. It's a much more organic network of things. And what that means is they can't do some things as efficiently as we can, but they can do other things very, very flexibly. You see them use terrorist tactics with these absolutely brutal bombings as they use bombings inside Baghdad and other locations. You also see them on the battlefield use tactics that shock us, big suicide bombs that lead the ground forces that go in, and they're here and they're there. But the most impressive thing about what they do is their use of information technology. Every day, their information, their tweets, their Facebook, and their other projections reach 100 million people. So that means every time they take a town, every time they execute somebody, every time they do something that's shocking or impressive or scary to us, they're getting that out to 100 million people. Now, some people are frightened by it because you feel like ISIS is right down the street. They're just about to take Baghdad. They're whatever. That's part of what they hope to do. But another thing they hope to do is, while it shocks many of us, they reach out, and much of what they do that's very hard, brutal, resonates with a part of the world. It resonates with a small percentage of people who are sort of happy to see somebody tough enough to stick it to the man, somebody who's just extreme enough to take charge of the chaos in the region. And they can propagate this information, and you say, well, they only can reach a small they only can convince a small percentage. A small percentage of 100 million is a lot of people. And so suddenly they get disaffected young men and women to come and join the cause, and they are actually having arguments inside who gets to be suicide bombers in the next attack. And so because it's this 21st century creation organism, we can't think of it like a traditional. It's not a nation state. It's not a traditional terrorist organization. And it's not something that we are going to bomb or destroy with a few bombs. It's not something that we are going to necessarily just shape or defeat on the battlefield. It's an idea and a virus that's going to have to be dealt with largely by people in the region. I mean, at the end of the day, the problem that they're so effective is because the erosion of stability in the region allows them to get traction where they shouldn't. They just shouldn't be able to have this kind of effect, but they can. So I know we hate hearing this because we really want the quick effect. We want to say if we go in and do a surgical operation, get just the right guy, ISIS will collapse and things will be back to normal. The bad news is I don't think that's true. I think the region is in enough disarray now where even if ISIS were gone tomorrow, the region would still be in a sorry state that would take engagement from the world and a framework to move forward in the region that's going to be really painstaking to create. And I think it's just going to take probably a generation to do that.
Your metaphor of a garden actually works for the enemy as well. Namely, we need to create an environment in which flowers don't bloom and tomatoes don't grow for ISIS, as well as making sure that we succeed with them on our own side. So I have just been told that I have demonstrated to both the people present and the people listening that I'm a political science major, because we actually have 10 more minutes. The program isn't as close to finish as I thought. So I'm going to take some more questions, the first of which was from someone asking, how do you manage cybersecurity in a team of teams?
Yeah. I think the first thing is cybersecurity is probably the new way of warfare. And we've got to make a decision whether it's war or not. If somebody bombed somewhere in America, we'd be upset and we'd say that's war and we're going to respond to that. If somebody were to hit one of our utilities or our bank system, we're not sure if that's war yet. And we haven't really come to grips with it. And I'm not 100% sure, but we got to get sure of it. We got to decide whether it's a never-ending conflict. And that the challenge with cyber is there's very low barrier to entry. You don't have to be a nation state to do cyber. You can sit in your basement in boxer shorts, and if you're lucky enough, you can cause a lot of damage. And so as a consequence, it's hard to deter people. Deterrence in the nuclear age said, if you use a nuclear weapon against us, we deter you because we will destroy you in the process. Well, you can't do that with cyber because there's nothing to go back against. And so as a consequence, for people with the desire and even a low level of capability, there's a chance that they can have disproportionate effect or at least constantly push your system so that you are constantly defending yourself. And then it may open gaps for more even organized and capable foes. One of the challenges that we have right now is there's a temptation across all of us to sort of be like wildebeests in the herd, and we're just hopeful that we're not the wildebeest that the lions get. And so we're in our company or we're in our organization, we say, oh boy, Target got hacked, JP Morgan got hacked, but we didn't get hacked, so let's lie low. And if you come out and say, hey, we just got a big problem, you got a problem, credibility in the marketplace. So there's a challenge, there's a reason sort of, like if you're paying almost as though you're paying bribes to someone, being blackmailed, you just would rather not on the front page. But what we've got to do is we've got to get this networked organization so that the government's got to be part of it, our organizations, not just businesses but also local organizations, are all going to have to get networked into this because we're going to have to learn from each other. If we all fight and defend ourselves separately, we won't defend ourselves. Nor can we have a single line of defense through which, if they get through CyberWise, we're destroyed. It's going to have to be this tremendous defense in depth. We spend an amazing amount of money now across the world on cybersecurity, and in the near term, I think that's just going to go up. But it's going to have to be networked. We're going to have to share information on this. We won't learn fast enough to deal with the next attack.
Several questions look at the organizational aspects of leadership. And in particular, you talk about a team of teams as a model in every endeavor. And several people asked questions that had to do with either the size of the organization for which this might be optimal, or whether you had seen in your business consulting that there are organizations that this might not be an optimal fit to. Do you have thoughts on those?
Yeah. Every situation's got to be a little bit different because every organization's got a slightly different requirement. But I have not yet seen a scale where the idea of passing information across the organization and creating these connections is not a step forward from where they are. I don't think that, you know, what we did in Joint Special Operations Command with everybody on the same video teleconference every day, I don't think that's a model for everyone. But I think it is a mindset that says if you are going to respond to things locally, as you must, because the situation on the ground and the speed at which they happen, you're going to have to change the model so that information gets down to that level along with the empowerment to act. I think when you get in big organizations, take them government or otherwise, you're going to have to create these construct between teams that pass that information like never before. So I don't think there's a scale, a strict limitation. I just think it looks a little different as we go up.
Mm-hmm. And I can't resist asking about the big organization that you were once a part of, because one of the questions that kept nagging at me as I was reading your terrific book was, why did it take so long for the Army to see the necessity of this? Why wasn't Somalia the moment at which we saw networks instead of structured organizations? Why weren't the Indian Wars of the 1870s and 1880s, which hung out there as a model? I'm asking both as a specific question, but more generally about how do we foster in big institutions a sense that the concept's wrong by which we are undertaking our activity?
Yeah. I would say partly because they weren't always wrong. Matthew Perry was sent, I think 1852, off to Japan to try to get Japan to open up to the United States and the West in general. And his orders basically consisted of go forth and figure it out. And you can do whatever you think makes sense. Now, why did they give him that latitude? No choice. They couldn't talk to him once he was gone. They couldn't try to micromanage him. So as a consequence, the only thing to do was to allow the subordinate given a task like that to have tremendous amount of latitude. Once we started to create the ability to connect, if you go back to the First World War, as we had wire communications and telegraph and whatnot, you started to control organizations. Then you started this tendency to try to micromanage. But the real thing about networking, I would say, is it really wasn't possible until about 15 years ago. We could talk networks, and at the high level, we could network major headquarters together, and we did have the capacity to do much of that. But it was really about 2002, 2003, when the proliferation of communications went through the force, really JSOC first because we were very well resourced, we could go down to every man essentially all the time. And that was such a revolution.
So it was technology.
And so technology intersected with this need. Now, the beauty for Al-Qaeda is they were created and they intersected with this technology and they just grew up with it and they didn't know any better. They just said, great, this is the way you operate. We'll set a car bomb off in Baghdad and we'll scare people in Mosul because we'll put it on the internet. They were great at it because that's just the way things were. We had an existing structure, and it's harder to change from an existing structure to something different than it is to grow automatically with it. But we suddenly had this technology, and that's what both allowed and forced us to make this significant shift.
I think that's a really good point, that it's actually successful organizations that have the most difficult time in engaging disruptive concepts. I very much like the way in the book you describe it as Al-Qaeda getting on an elevator that was already going up. And the technology that enabled that is a really interesting point. We have only a couple of minutes left, honest this time. So I am going to give the last question to someone who asks about something actually that Walter Isaacson had mentioned in the foreword to your book, which is about your project on youth national service.
Well, you just hit the press to talk button here. Okay. I feel very strongly about this, as you're probably going to figure out seconds from now. I think citizenship in America has eroded. And when I describe citizenship, I don't say that it's a card you have. I don't say it's something you get because you were born here. It's not a gift. And it's not even something you take a test, raise your hand, and suddenly you have it. And it's not a set of entitlements. It doesn't say, wow, I get the protection of the law. And it's not limited in its responsibility. It doesn't say if I pay my taxes and I vote, I check the block, I've done my citizenship. If you think what citizenship is, it's just an agreement between a group of people. There's no such thing as the United States until we get together and say, we agree to a covenant between all of us that we are going to be the United States. We are going to have a nation. And that agreement says, we're going to get certain things from this. We're going to get shared security. We're going to take care of each other. And it means we've got certain responsibilities. We are going to pledge ourselves to every other American. And so suddenly you've got this covenant that is citizenship. Now, where do you learn it? Well, you go to school and you take civics class or you read a book and you get citizenship. And I don't think that's right. I think you can get the idea of it. Somebody can tell you. I think you get it by watching. You get it by watching people who act and how they act and what they do. And I think you get it by doing. When Tom Brokaw wrote the book, The Greatest Generation, a lot of people said they were the greatest generation because they won World War II. And I don't think that's what he meant at all. I think he meant they were the greatest generation because they went through this experience of 16 million Americans in uniform and every American in some way or another affected by the shared sacrifice. And because of that, they came away with a different sense of responsibility. This was theirs, to which they had contributed, in which they had invested, and to which they had responsibility. And what I think we've done over the last probably 40 years is allow that to erode. We've told people, well, you don't really have to do anything. A few people can serve if they want to. You can go in the Peace Corps, you can go in the military, you can go in AmeriCorps, but that's kind of only if it's your thing. And I don't feel that way. I think everybody should serve. And I think the way to do this is give every young American an opportunity to do a year of fully paid national service. The product of this, I think the product is not the work they do. The product is the alumni we create. Because everybody who does something comes out different. Even if you go in for one reason, you come out different. I went in the Army because I thought it'd be interesting. I did. And it was. But after a few years, I served for a completely different reason. And I think that happens with everybody. I think we could change the feeling in America if we do this. Now, people say it's big, it's hard. There are 4 million young people in every year group. How can we possibly do this? How can we possibly not do this? How can we be too scared to do this? If we think it is fundamental to the future and strength of the nation, how can we not? Thank you.
What a beautiful note. on that beautiful note, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.